Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the post-Brexit edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, the fallout of the Brexit vote. Will Italian banks collapse the euro? And what about the Brazilian Olympics? Let's begin episode 346.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns.
We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. We're going to start today's show off a little differently. Maybe a tad old school. Well, maybe mid-school, as in, you know, the previous shows we did about Harper and all that. No, this isn't going to be another tirade about Harper or about Canadian politics either. But if you may have noticed, there have been a number of major political events going on, and while I've been holding off talking about them, I wanted to see where the chips will lie. Who will close the door after horses, and who's crying over spilled milk? Let's start off with the mother country. What? To which mother country am I referring? Well, one of the joys and complexities of living in a multicultural society is that what are simple terms in one country are a little bit more convoluted in a nation like Canada. Our Canada, originally inhabited by First Nations, then settled by the English and French, and then, in the 20th century, immigration from all around the world makes the term mother country fuzzier. So, what would pass as my mother country, Great Britain? Well, as Charlton Heston put it,
finally, really did it. You maniacs! You blew it up! Oh, damn you! God!
What did they do? Voted Brexit. That is, the referendum to have Great Britain leave the European Union passed. The stay side got 48% of the vote, and the leave side got 52%. Now, to simple people like me and you, that seems like a hair-thin majority, only 4%. But from what I've been reading and hearing from commentators on both sides, in a vote like this, when all things are considered, this was a pretty firm leave win. So although it seems like a weak win, it apparently is actually a strong wind. That said, one of the more interesting sentiments to arise after the vote was a buyer's remorse. You had reporters walking around and talking to people who said they voted to leave as sort of a protest vote and never thought it would pass. That if they knew that would be the outcome, they wouldn't have voted to leave. Many of those and others have called for a kind of redo on the vote. Again, with the idea being, if only I knew the leave side would win, we would have voted differently. We would have voted, and other such comments. Sadly, no, you got your vote, you screwed it up. Well, making beds and lying in them come to mind. Another interesting thing to arise out of the morning after is the, I'm not sure what metaphor that works here, rats leaving ship, but essentially the leave side came out and basically said, you know all that stuff we said about sending Brussels hundreds of millions of pounds a week, that leaving will give us back control of our borders, open up trade? Well, that was kind of rubbish. We didn't think we'd win either, so who really cared? And as a result, when the leave side won, nobody had any plans. The leave side didn't know what was going to happen. The stay side, the government of Great Britain, had no idea what was going to happen. Some things, though, did come true. The next day, the Financial Times Stock Exchange, or the FTSE, as it's called, their Dow Jones, or TSE, well, it plummeted, dropped by more than 3%. Which may not sound like much, but that's a loss of over £100 billion. It's estimated the global market lost $2 trillion. The UK lost its AAA lending rate. The pound dropped to a 30-year low. Government bonds dropped to the lowest returns ever. Now, since the results were announced, there's been some recovery in the stock market, but the pound is still in the toilet and bonds are still at their record lows. With the takeaway message being is that because no one thought Leave would win, no one has any idea where it's going to go or what happens next. There was another phenomena that few people were predicting, that one of the outcomes of the Brexit win, Brad's leaving ship phenomena, well, the next day, the UK Prime Minister, David Cameron, announced he would be resigning as PM in the following months to, quote, the negotiations with the European Union will need to begin under a new Prime Minister. And I think it right, this Prime Minister takes a decision about when to trigger Article 50. This seems a bit of a bad sport, in my opinion. And perhaps some of his preppy, posh schooling shows through. What you would say if you were playing a soccer game and you scored one past the goalie, and then the goalie grabs the ball, stomps off the playing field and saying something, if you're not going to let me win, I don't want to play. Well, it seems like now this has a term. It's you're pulling a Cameron. So having lost the vote, instead of staying on to negotiate the best deal for the UK outside of the EU, instead of standing with the British people who re-elected him with a majority just 13 months earlier, he just basically took the easiest and soonest way out as he possibly could, irrespective of how much more destabilizing that would be. He just basically said, it's not my problem anymore, I'm out of here. Or as another famous person once put it,
okay, that does it. Screw you guys, I'm going home.
Now, although I think it's bad leadership that Cameron left as quickly as he did, that he didn't invoke Article 50 himself, more on that later, that he did not at least wait long enough to help stabilize the nation in the seismic shock that was the Brexit win. No, not enough. He thought he would take the stunned nation and give it another bop on the ears just to maximize the uncertainty and confusion that was the inevitable outcome of a Leave win. No, instead we got...
But Carmen, we're trying to... Screw you guys.
But one person a phenomenon does not make. No, shortly after Cameron announced his departure from the political landscape, the winner of sorts, Boris Johnson, shocked everyone by stating that he would not enter the foray to replace Cameron. A lot of people, including yours truly, thought that Johnson, who is a member of Cameron's party and was widely expected to replace Cameron if the Brexit side won, that his support for Brexit was a gambit to replace Cameron in the next election, irrespective of whether the Leave side won or not. Well, jaws hit respective floors when a week later, Johnson announced that he would not be seeking the leadership of the Conservative Party. Johnson's actions were the result of the withdrawal support and, quote, character assassination by one of his former supporters, Michael Gove, Secretary of Justice, who fancied he had a shot to be king. This reminds me of one of the famous lines I heard in Yes, Prime Minister. And let's listen into a great example of how you do a character assassination, which is totally what Gove did to Boris Johnson.
Well, the Prime Minister is planning to appoint Alexander Jameson, Mr. Clean. So that's one bit of good news.
It's appalling news.
Oh, are you going to try and change the Prime Minister's mind?
No, I'm going to change the Prime Minister's mind.
Well, he seems very keen on him.
I know, so that'll be my starting point. When you wish to suggest that somebody is perhaps not the ideal choice...
You rubbish them?
The first stage is to express absolute support.
Why?
Because you don't want to go on record as saying somebody's no good. You must be seen to be their friend. After all, it is necessary to get behind someone before you can stab them in the back.
But Alexander Jameson is good. He's extremely honest and efficient.
Excellent. So that's the second stage. You list all his praiseworthy qualities, especially those that make him unsuitable for the job. And then you praise them to the point where they become a vice. That's the third stage. Or, better still, you oversimplify his views by labeling them, as you just did.
You mean Mr. Clean?
Yes. But I think we can do better than that. Do sit down, Bernard. Now, isn't he a churchgoer?
Yes, I believe he was once a lay preacher, a long time ago.
Splendid news. We can certainly use that against him. What a charming man. Hasn't an enemy in the world. But is he really up to dealing with some of those rogues in the city?
Well, that won't wash. Jameson's pretty tough.
Then we'll say he's too tough. That's the fourth stage. You name all his bad points by defending and excusing them. You know...
Oh, it probably doesn't matter that he was a conscientious objector. I'm sure nobody's really questioned his patriotism. Or I think the criticisms of him for bankrupting his last company weren't entirely fair.
Well, that would certainly do it.
Well, if it doesn't, you can always hint at a hidden scandal. If he's not married, hint at homosexuality.
If he is married,
adultery. With a lady who is beyond reproach, one of the royals, for instance.
Or a television newsreader.
Well, what if he's obviously happily married?
Well, then say he's extremely puritanical, or he drinks, or he's having psychiatric treatment. Really, Bernard, the possibilities are endless. Listen and learn, Bernard.
The best point, of course, needs to be repeated.
After all, it is necessary to get behind someone before you can stab them in the back.
As it turned out, Grove came in a distant third out of three candidates in a vote to replace Cameron. And as politics goes, karma rules, as Grove is no longer a minister of the crown, while Boris somehow is now the foreign secretary, one of the highest and most powerful ministries in government. So Justin Desserts come to mind. The winner in all this backroom haranguing, Home Secretary Theresa May, was a supporter of the stay side. Another, and perhaps most bizarre example of this rats leaving ship phenomena, was the surprise announcement of the one person who really won the vote, clearly with no backstabbing intrigue or complicating things. You see, one might explain why Cameron might leave, sour grapes, and Boris, the betrayed, has ended up well-placed to win the next war, and Michael Grove, the betrayer, well, just where is he now? The only leader of a major political party to have actively campaigned for the Leave side, the one man in the UK to say, I came, I saw, I conquered, the man whose mission in life was to get Britain out of the EU, so much so that he actually got himself elected a member of the European Union Parliament as a way to find a platform to espouse his anti-EU sentiments. Yes, I'm talking about Nigel Farage, the slightly too overt racist, well, bigot, his wife is German after all. Nigel, after winning the vote, after being the only party leader to win in this fiasco, announced he was retiring from politics. Hearkening to a Cameron-esque type response, well, now that I've made a complete mess of things, it's time for me to walk away. Let others pick up the pieces and make the best of what has been done.
Screw you guys, I'm going home.
And we kind of have an exception that sort of proves the rule. In the wake of the Brexit win, the Labour Party, that in a number of MPs of that party, have attempted to pull a coup d'etat and dump their leader, Jeremy Corbyn. You have to love politics. The Conservatives and UKIP want their leaders to stay, and their leaders are leaving. The Labour Party wants their leader to leave, and he's staying. Why? Well, this is where we get a little socialist, a little real democracy, a little elitist slash money in politics. When Corbyn was elected leader of the Labour Party, it was a kind of WTF moment, a what just happened here moment for the Labour Party. After a humiliating defeat of Labour in 2015, a lot of the blame for the loss was attributed to Ed Miliband, who is Labour in name, but a posh, upper class, just like Cameron, not really a man of the people. So Labour, to their credit, changed how the leadership was elected. Before, it was a mix of popular vote, there was an electoral college of sorts, and well, it was kind of, let's get input from the regular people, but it's the party elites who actually selected the right sort of person for the leader. The problem being, big money or what have you, can co-opt the system and put their guy in power, irrespective of the wishes of the majority people. In an attempt to sort of right the ship, the Labour Party tried something new, real democracy. One person, one vote. You still had to be a card-carrying Labour member, but your vote as a cabinet member was equal to Billy Britton, ironworker from Kent. The result meant that Corbyn won easily on the first ballot. It should also be noted that Corbyn is old-school Labour, a real socialist, a man of the people. Well, it seems the party elites, the money powers that be, saw the Brexit loss as a great way to get rid of Cameron for one of their own toady populists. Someone who understood where real control is supposed to lay. With the one percenters. They had hoped that in the face of a large revolt by elected members of the Labour Party, Corbyn would resign. Unfortunately for them, they were up against one politician in Britain who seemed to not only really be who he said he was, a socialist who cared about the average UK citizen, but also knew that if he stood his ground, that people would support him. That the real power was, and always will be, in the masses, if only they realized the greatness of their power. In fact, there's a new term for his supporters, that they call him the Corbynistas. So returning to our theme, Corbyn seems to be the last man standing, and though the forces against him are daunting, they are not as mighty as the real power, the power of the people. This complete meltdown in leadership in the UK was not something anyone was expecting, and I'm sure not only helped deepen the instability and uncertainty in the wake of the Brexit victory, but will leave a lasting scar not only in the British psyche, but making what, in my opinion, was a bad decision, a bad situation, much worse in the long run. Just think about what poor politicians, those Labour shadow cabinet ministers, have to be. I mean, you got one of the biggest slapdowns for the Conservative Party ever. UKIP, leadership abandoned. The right is in complete disarray. And instead of sitting back and trying to rally around their leader, rally around their party, use this opportunity to totally trounce the Conservative side at one of their weakest moments. No, they figure, hey, this is a great time to implode and attack ourselves. Why should we let the Conservatives have all the fun of chopping off their head when we can chop off our own head? Anyway, I digress. Okay, so that was the immediate aftermath, and things have settled down a little bit. What's next? Well, Cameron originally said that he would stay on till about October, then a replacement would be selected, and only then Article 50 would be invoked. Okay, so what is Article 50? Article 50 is part of the document called the Lisbon Treaty, a document that creates and governs what is the EU, membership obligations, and the rules. This article, when invoked, states officially that a nation is leaving the EU. What happens next, and how long before said nation is no longer bound by the treaty? You may be thinking, it sets up exactly how the UK will leave. So there should not have been any ambiguity about what would happen when the Leave side won Britain. It's all there in Article 50. Well, you shouldn't be faulted for thinking that would be the case, but alas, no. The article is actually only a couple paragraphs consisting of really 5 points. The first simply states that any member is free to leave whenever they wish. The second says a bit more, and I stress the bit part. Paraphrasing, it states that a nation must tell the Council its intent to leave. Then, and I quote here, the Union shall negotiate and conclude agreement with that state, setting out the arrangements for its withdrawal, taking account of the framework for its future relationship with the Union. Basically, it says they negotiate some agreement about it leaving. Not much more than that. The third states that the parties have 2 years from invocation, regardless of how the negotiations go. After that time, the treaty will no longer apply to the exiting nation, although that deadline can be extended with unanimous agreement. Fourth point states, and what would be obvious to you and me, but must be made explicit to lawyers and politicians, that the exiting nation doesn't get to vote on the extension and, well, like, duh, its EU member representative cannot be part of the Union's negotiating team. The last states that a former member may apply for readmission, but it gets no special treatment. You join as if you never were a member. Fair, I guess. So this leads me to ask then, what are each side's desires in negotiation? Well, thanks to the referendum, what the UK wants has pretty much been well stated, if ill-defined. First, they still want access to the EU market. They don't want to pay the EU any money. They want complete control over immigration, those people from outside the EU, and migration, those people from inside the EU. The aim is simple. Only let in who Britain wants in. That said, the real reason behind immigration control, beyond the racist ones, is security. And migration, it's all about the jobs. Oh yes, and they also want what the Leave side called sovereignty. That is, they don't want to follow any laws or regulations enacted by some distant politician in Brussels. No, the maximum distance a politician can be to pass a law applying to all the lands of the United Kingdom is London. The British side will also have a very positive attitude, if a melancholy one, towards the negotiations. Let's be tough, but in the end, can't we just all be friends? The EU side is, how shall we say, a bit more conflicted. On the one hand, UK trade with the EU is good for the EU. The UK's leaving would have a small impact on the whole with regards to people moving around within the EU. Any rules or regulations the UK wish not to apply to itself has nothing or little to do with the rest of the EU. No, the only real point of negotiations are trade and borders. Oh, yes, and there's that $13 billion the UK contributes to the EU. That may also come up. One might argue the EU should also be positive about negotiations. Except for one thing the EU must have in mind, that the UK side will not. And this is sort of setting a precedent. You see, the EU may take a very hard and tough stance against Britain. Why? Well, there's been a number of rumblings from other EU members about leaving. They will look to see how the EU treats Britain as an indicator of how much leaving will cost them. In this vein, it's in the EU's interest to make this as painful as possible for the UK, to discourage other nations from following suit, even if the EU makes decisions that are harmful to both the UK and the EU. Now that being said, there are a couple of models being floated around about what Brexit will actually end up looking like. The most likely model, if everyone's positive, is the Norway model. Norway is part of what's called the European Economic Area, or the EEA. This gives Norway almost as much access to the EU market as a member nation, but not complete access. There are limitations in agriculture and fisheries, areas very important to Britain. To gain this access, Norway pays the EU about as much as a member nation does. They do also follow the same regulations as member nations. That said, Norway has no formal say in the governance of the EU. Basically, they have no voting powers. If the UK follows this model, the stateside kind of wins, although the UK does lose. Why? Well, they will still have to pay Brussels billions, one of the main issues the Brexit side was campaigning against. They will still have to follow all the laws and regulations of Brussels, that sovereignty thing. And migration will remain the same, so jobs and securities will all be about the same. Great, the Leave side loses even when it wins. But alas, a post-Brexit Britain will no longer have a say in those regulations or laws. It will no longer be able to directly influence or mold the policies it will likely have to accept anyway. Also, if the EU wants to play hardball, it's not likely to let Britain off that easily. No, as I said earlier, they might want to make this as painful as possible. So perhaps they'll follow the Swiss model. Yes, it may surprise some people that the nation that's literally at the heart of the EU is not actually a member of the Union. The Swiss have a lot of access to the EU, thanks to the European Free Trade Agreement, which gives them access to much, but not all, of the EU markets. However, it has to supplement the EFTA, other bilateral treaties over other areas like agriculture, banking, and other things. It's a much messier and patchwork landscape than what Norway has. The Swiss border is open to EU members, which is something the UK expressly did not want. Again, much of the criticism the Leave side leveled against the EU was the openness to people, that this openness was a threat to the security of Britain, to the jobs of Britain. The Swiss don't contribute to the EU budget overall. It can participate in some EU programs provided it pays into those programs, a kind of a la carte approach. This the UK would very much like. One of the consistent things on the Leave side was that it liked some parts of the EU, it didn't like other parts of the EU, and it would like to pick and choose what it participates in. This is the Swiss have. But, yet again, Switzerland must follow EU regulations, more or less. Not as automatic as Norway, but as a standard part of a trade agreement as negotiated. And remember, Switzerland is a small economy compared to the EU. The Swiss need the EU more than the EU need the Swiss. So EU rules tend to be the law of the land anyway. The EU economy is much larger than the Swiss, and thanks to the integration of having been a member, gives the UK a much stronger hand at the negotiation table than the Swiss have had. But that works both ways. It's just as easy for the UK to follow what the EU does to ensure trade is maintained. Don't rock the cart. And although the UK has a large economy, it is still very, very much smaller than the EU as a whole. And again, the Swiss have no say in the governance of the EU. Neither will the UK. Another model, sometimes called the Canadian model, which is basically just a free trade agreement. We have the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, or CETA, which relative to early models is very limited in scope, i.e. it only really covers trade, and then only some trade, not all. But to be fair, the agreement signed gives access to about 98% of the EU market. There's a similar agreement with Singapore, which has a much less access to the EU. Our agreement also provides easier access to some of the financial things, but again, very limited. That said, there's no special access to EU migration. Canada controls its borders. It passes what laws and regulations it wants, although it still must abide by EU rules when exporting into the EU. And it pays Brussels nothing. Then there's what we shall call the Russian model. That is, no special treatment of any kind on anything. This is what will happen at the end of 2 years after Article 50 is invoked and no deal has been reached or no extension applied. So now that the UK has a new Prime Minister, we're all waiting for Article 50 to be voted. And again, we have a hiccup. The EU wants London to pull the trigger right away and let negotiations start. London, on the other hand, wants to pre-negotiate a deal before invoking. For obvious reasons, and keeping in mind, until the article is invoked, the UK is still a member. The more Britain has a sense of what kind of deal it has if it leaves. If it appears the EU is going to play hardball, if the Union wants to use Britain as an example to scare other would-be exiters, Britain could just call the referendum more of a public opinion poll, and we were never really going to do it. It's not binding or anything, and they could just ignore it and remain a part of the EU. There would probably be some political blowback in Britain. Governments may or may not fall, but in the long run, EU keeps its seat in the EU. And that is if the EU still wants the UK. Again, it can't expel members, but that seems unlikely. That said, if it looks like the UK is getting a good deal, thanks to those pre-evocation negotiations, it might strengthen the UK's acceptance of leaving the EU. It would also send a signal to others that there will be no exacting price to pay if other nations, like the Netherlands, wants to exit the EU. This gives the UK the balance of power. That is why the EU does not want to have any pre-evoking negotiations. From the Union standpoint, once Article 50 is evoked, the clock is ticking, and the pressure will be on the UK to make a deal. Remember, the EU has little to lose if the treaty stops applying to the UK, compared to economic collapse or worse for Britain. If the EU plays hardball, it can force the UK to make more concessions than it might not want to, with a pending deadline approaching. So really, the first negotiation to arise from Brexit is when the first negotiation will arise from Brexit. And that only time will tell. Oh yes, and there are some other minor, well, major possible faults of the Brexit win. Some of my loyal listeners may remember that not so long ago, Scotland had its own leave or stay vote vis-a-vis the UK. Scotland voted to stay with a 54 to 44% result, a much stronger than the Brexit vote. That said, one of the major arguments for the stay part of the UK side was the EU. If Scotland voted to leave, it would have to negotiate membership into the EU. Not that most people thought that that was unlikely, Scotland would be, in my humble opinion, a welcomed member of the EU, and its entry would be pretty quick and painless. That said, the stay in the UK side used its membership as a strong incentive to vote no to leaving the UK side, and they won, so good on you. Now that the UK has decided to leave the EU, it seems likely that Scotland will have another vote on leaving the UK, and that the Leave side will likely win. It's not so much an if, but a when question. So a likely, if not a possible fallout of the Brexit win, is a loss of Scotland. And if that wasn't enough, it seems that Northern Ireland might also take a hard look at UK membership. You see, Northern Ireland wants to be part of the greater Irish nation. And with both the UK and Ireland being members of the EU, well, it can act like the island nation is united while still maintaining a sliver of independence by remaining part of the UK. Well, with Britain leaving the EU, it means, depending on the negotiations, that Northern Ireland will be cut off from the Irish Republic, which to the people of Northern Ireland, it's not a good thing. Yes, it comes as a bit of a surprise to some of us who grew up during the era of the IRA and the war between the Catholics and the Protestants in Northern Ireland, that union was possible. Well, it seems that things have gone quite well, that the North and the South so much want to be united, well, that the UK leaving may finally be the nail in the coffin of the British Irish. And after a century of struggle, Northern Ireland may well vote to leave the UK and join the Republic, finally reuniting the Irish people again after a century or so of separation? So another result, and I would, at least in part, put this as a very likely outcome, another result of the Leave win will be the end of the UK. It will no longer be the United Kingdom, but simply England and Wales. What seemed a simple thing can have ramifications that will reshape the world and history as we know it. Who said politics, history, was boring? It can, and it seems to will, have a major effect on the daily life of Europeans, Brits, UK, whom have you. Well, let's negotiate a little pause as we return after this break.
Would you like to get updates on your smartphone in an emergency, even if a cell tower is down? It is possible if the FM chip is activated in your phone. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 CITR FM, your exit from fiction and your union to reality. And we're back. From Brexit to the collapse of the euro, maybe the EU as a whole. A clip from the Real News Network about the possible pending nationalization of the banking system in Italy. Trigger warning, this is an information-rich clip and may not be as entertaining as yours truly, but you might actually learn something. Let's listen to an alternative opinion to the mainstream media.
Another banking crisis looms on Europe's horizon, but this time it will unfold from Italy, Europe's fourth largest economy, where loan defaults threaten to endanger not only Italy's economy, but all of Europe. There are over 300 billion euros in bad loans in the banking system, which represents about 18% of all loans, which is an unusually high level when compared to other countries. For example, less than 5% of France's loans and only 1.5% of Germany's loans are considered to be bad. After the 2012 banking crisis, the European Union passed rules that require bank shareholders to pay the bailout before EU intervenes. In Italy's case, the shareholders tend to be small private households that stand to lose a significant amount of their savings. Whether the banks fail or whether they are bailed out by their shareholders, the government of Prime Minister Matteo Renzi stands to lose no matter what happens. Let's have a look at what the president of Banca Popolare di Milano, the supervisory board member Nicola Rossi, had to say about all of this.
There might be one single problem in the Italian banking system, and everybody is doing his lot in order to face it, tackle it, and provide a solution. As far as the Italian banking system as a whole is concerned, I don't think there is a systemic problem, and I think the stress tests that are on their way will quite clearly suggest that there's no a systemic banking problem in Italy.
With us to discuss the situation in Europe is Dimitri Lascaris and Gerald Epstein. Dimitri is a class action lawyer and currently the justice critic in the shadow cabinet of the Green Party of Canada. He's also a board member of the Real News Network. Good to have you with us, Dimitri.
Thank you, Sharmini.
And Jerry Epstein is co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute and professor of economics at UMass Amherst. Thank you so much for joining us, Jerry.
Good to be here.
So, Jerry, I'm going to go to you first. The latest so-called stress test of European banks are about to be released, or will be by the time we publish this, and it is widely expected that they will show just how bad the situation is in Italy. How bad is it, Jerry?
Well, it's very bad for these banks, and as you said in the intro, that means it's also very bad for the people of Italy, especially the people who lent money to these banks, and the government. The banks, but I'm not sure the stress tests themselves will actually reveal how bad it is. In fact, there's some evidence that the stress tests themselves might soft pedal it, but we can come back to that. For the banks themselves, as you said, they have somewhere between 20% and by some measures, 40% non-performing loans. It's well understood that several of them are essentially bankrupt and need a bailout. But as you also said, the new rules in the European Union prevent governments from bailing them out unless they first, the creditors first lose their money, which means in this case, some big investors, but also a lot of small Italian investors. So there's a standoff. The European Union is insisting on this, but the government says no, we can't impose these kinds of costs on our people, so we need to bail out the banks. At the same time, everybody's tired of all of these bank bailouts, so it puts the government in a very precarious position.
And Dimitri, let you get in on this. We are coming from the experience of the Greek banks, but what's actually taking place here?
Well, these stress tests, this is going to be the third round of stress tests conducted by the European Banking Authority. Stress tests were conducted in 2011 and 2014. The last round in 2014 looked at about 130 banks. And the EBA, the European Banking Authority, gave a pass or grade fail to each of the banks. And only one bank, Monte dei Paschi of Italy, the third largest lender and the oldest bank in Europe, failed. All the others passed. And collectively, the EBA claimed that the capital requirements for the 130 or so banks that were examined were about 25 billion euros. As Jerry quite rightly indicated, there was a lot of skepticism around these numbers and these results. And in fact, three academics from Sasha Stefan of the Center for European Economic Research, Vidal Acharia from New York University, and Diane Pierre of the University of Lausanne issued a study in 2014 in which they concluded that the actual capital requirement was in excess for the 130 banks that were tested was in excess of 770 billion euros, or more than approximately 32 times what the EBA had claimed they needed. This time around, there are even more serious questions surrounding the plausibility of these stress tests, because the EBA is not going to give a pass or fail grade, and it's only looking at about 51 banks. And that means that the effect of its decision, or the parameters of its study, is that banks from Greece and Cyprus and Portugal, which are really, especially in Greece and Cyprus, in a horrific condition, are not included in the stress tests. What's interesting about the explanation for not giving a pass or grade fail, which is the fault, let me read it to you so you know what the justification is. The EBA says the objective of the crisis stress test was to identify possible capital shortfalls and require immediate recapitalization actions. And this is the key language. As banks have now moved to a more steady state setting, the aim of the 2016 exercise is rather to assess remaining vulnerabilities and understand the impact of hypothetical adverse market dynamics on banks. So what, putting aside what move to a more steady state setting means, whatever it means, it seems difficult to accept as a factual proposition that banks are now in a more steady state setting. The banks in Europe have just been eviscerated. Their share prices have been eviscerated this year. Deutsche Bank, which is identified by the IMF as the riskiest big bank, and the largest lender in Europe, has seen its stock price fall by something in the range of 50% this year. The Italian banking sector has seen its market capitalization decline by over 50% this year. The banks in Europe are operating in a very challenging environment because there are ultra low interest rates, which are eating into their lending profit margins. And the Brexit vote isn't helping. It's created additional uncertainty, which, by the way, is not going to be examined in these tests. So when you look at what's actually happening in the European banking sector, the idea that they're in a steady state is highly dubious. And the absence of a pass or fail grade raises real questions about the legitimacy of these tests. And, you know, to sort of add fuel to the fire, these three academics have now, the ones I mentioned previously, have come out with a new study in which they estimate. And what they do in this study is they look at something that the EBA is not looking at. They ask, you know, what's going to happen? What will the capital requirements be if there is a 40% drop in global stock markets in 6 months? And that's something in that magnitude happened just a few years ago in 2008, 2009. So this is not an implausible scenario. And they conclude that the banks, the 51 banks that are being examined, would need a capital in excess of 900 billion euros. And that even if the bail-in mechanism were employed, certain of these banks would still require government support. So it will be very interesting to see what these results show tonight. I suspect that the number we're going to be given is going to be nowhere near 900 billion euros. That would be very surprising.
So, Jerry, it looks as if, based on what Dimitri and you've just said, that the major banks will have to be bailed out one way or another. What does this mean for Italy and for ordinary Italians? That's one thing. And after all, as we know, several countries in Europe will also face the consequences of all of this.
Well, if a bailout has to occur, and we don't know for sure that it will, but it, at least in the case of Italy, it seems, for at least some of the banks, likely. It creates a big problem for Italy, as it did for Greece, because, among other things, it's in the Eurozone. And there are all these fiscal limits and requirements. And if they have to use some of that fiscal space to bail out the banks, that means that their debt problems and their austerity problems will get even worse, because they won't have the fiscal space to provide other kinds of government spending. And in fact, if you look at the causes of all this and go more deeply, we see that the economic crisis caused by the banks in the first place and the austerity imposed by the Eurozone and the Euro rules are really at the root cause of this. I mean, in Italy, GDP has fallen more than 10% since 2007 when the crisis started. Industrial capacity has fallen by 20%. The IMF isn't predicting that the GDP growth in Italy is going to reach what it was in 2007 until 2025. So you have austerity and stagnation for as long as the eye can see. So unless something dramatic changes, this is just going to pile on one set of misery and austerity on the Italian people and other Europeans on top of the other.
Right. Let me go to Dimitri here. Dimitri, we've learned a lot from Greece. What are the takeaways? What options are there that could be implemented here that wouldn't have the same effect it did in Greece?
But I think, I have to embrace enthusiastically what Jerry said about austerity. The EU's austerity fixation is creating an extremely challenging economic environment, particularly in countries in the Mediterranean basin, like Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal. And that is piling pressure on these banks. It's causing their non-performing loans to soar. In Italy, the non-performing loans of the banking sector are currently in the range of 17%. Only Greece, Cyprus, Slovenia, and Portugal have higher rates of non-performing loans. They're actually astronomical. In Greece, I think they're in the range of like 40%, and Cyprus around 50%. This is all intimately tied to the austerity program, of course. And so the EU is, adopting economic policies that are hammering the banks. And then turning around and saying, well, we're going to throw up impediments to governments bailing them out, even when failing to do so could have very adverse impacts on people who are in an economically vulnerable position. I think if we see the EU prevent a resolution in Italy that is going to, protect particularly small bank investors, this is only going to serve to increase animosity towards the European Union in Italy, which is already climbing, and as it has probably throughout the European Union. It's just going to be one more nail in the coffin of the so-called union that the Europeans sought to construct decades ago. So it's a very challenging situation, very much of the EU's and the ECB's own making. And it is, in my view, it has the potential to exacerbate the forces right now that are leading to the disintegration of the European Union.
And Jerry, what alternatives are there? What can the European Central Bank do tries to, you know, ensure that what happened to Greece and other countries that Dimitri just mentioned isn't what we're going to see in Italy?
Well, austerity isn't the answer, as Dimitri said. And so there are very strict rules on what the European Central Bank can do. But essentially, these banks that are in such trouble have to be nationalized, the ones that are causing so much problem, nationalization, and then used to invest in the economies, lend to small business, invest in infrastructure, and so forth. And then the only other solution is to figure a way out of this austerity trap, because short of that, there's not going to be a long-term solution.
And the one thing I would add to what Jerry said, I suspect Jerry would agree with this, is that once these banks have been nationalized, whether they're nationalized or not, their management should be removed.
Oh, absolutely.
This was a major criticism of the bailouts that happened in connection with the 2008-2009 financial crisis. I mean, these people were allowed to stay in place, people who had, at a minimum, been grossly incompetent in the management of these banks, and perhaps even worse, had behaved in an outright fraudulent manner. And had contributed enormously to this catastrophic financial crisis that the world experienced. You've got to get rid of those managers. And I don't see any real appetite amongst the European elite for doing that at this stage. I mean, if that's a key part of the solution, in my view.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Next, we have another interview from the Real News Network with David Zarin, author of Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the fight for democracy. He discusses the perfect opportunity for the anti-democratic forces in Brazil to market themselves as if they were saviors of the nation. Let's listen to another alternative view.
On Friday, August 5th, Rio de Janeiro will be hosting 2016 Summer Olympic Games. These Olympics have been mired with controversy. Tens of thousands of Brazilians recently protested against them because of the enormous cost and the amount of displacement the construction for the Olympics have caused. It is said that up to 77,000 people have been displaced from their homes because of the construction. Also, there has been some concern that venues might not be completed in time. At the same time, this will be one of the largest Olympics in history, with over 10,000 athletes participating and over 85,000 security forces protecting them from terrorist attacks, double the number of the London Summer Olympics in 2012. With us to discuss the politics and the controversy surrounding the Rio Olympics is Dave Zarin. Dave recently released a second edition of his book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. He's also a columnist for The Nation magazine. Thank you so much for joining us, Dave.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before we go into the actual Olympics, Dave, let's talk about the politics in Brazil. As most people know, there has been an impeachment process underway, and President Dilma Rousseff is, of course, suspended, awaiting the decision of Senate committee that's processing her impeachment. And now, on Friday, charges had been laid against former President Lula, as he's been indicted for obstruction of justice. So what's going on the political front?
Yeah, I mean, what's going on is that this is no coincidence. I mean, the timings of both the attacks on Dilma, the impeachment of Dilma, and this indictment of Lula are all very interestingly timed around the Olympic Games, when the attention of the world is on Brazil. This is about a message being sent, I believe, to foreign investors, to international commodities markets, that investing in Brazil is in fact a good investment. Brazil is currently mired in its worst economic crisis in decades. I mean, some say in the history of the country. And this is all happening in the wake of unprecedented economic growth under Lula and then Dilma as well. And that there, this has so clearly been timed around the crisis, around thinking that they could get international cash flows and investment back into the country if they show that they could bring the Workers' Party to heel. And what's so ironic about this is that the very laws that Lula is being prosecuted under are laws that he himself signed into the legislative history of the country for the purposes of fighting corruption, which has long plagued Brazil's politics. I mean, it's just very difficult to take any of this stuff seriously or look at it objectively, given how widespread we know corruption to be in Brazil and how it crosses all political parties.
Now, David, this particular Olympics has got a whole lot of controversies piling up on top of each other. I mean, there are the issues of the demonstrations that are going on, pro-Rousseff, anti-Temer. What numbers are showing up? And how significant are they?
The protests themselves, I mean, are actually much smaller than they've been in recent years. For example, in 2013, before the Confederations Cup, these anti-World Cup protests that took place around the country were significantly larger than the ones that we're currently seeing, largely because there's just a great deal of demoralization in the country. I mean, there is no politician right now in Brazil who holds any kind of a standing. And that's what's so cynical about this attack on the Workers' Party, is that what it's done is it's driven, and let's make no mistake about it, I think the Workers' Party set themselves up for this in many, many different kinds of ways that we could talk about if you like, including letting enemies of their program into their own cabinet as a way to showcase a kind of national unity, those very enemies who later testified against them and stabbed them in the back. But what it's done is it's driven a stake in the heart of the idea that democratic popular participation leads to change. So my last trip there, I was really struck by two things. And my last trip there was just in May. I was struck by both the protests that I did go to, how they were not connected to any formal political party, which is different than Brazil's history and, you know, really the whole region's history. And I was also struck by the level of cynicism by people who were former activists, who just felt generally disgusted, betrayed, cynical about the whole thing.
And if they were not affiliated with any of the parties, what were the protests about?
It's very interesting because, you know, there's the old expression that nature abhors a vacuum. And in this case, the vacuum has been provided by people's demoralization with the Workers' Party and with class-based union politics, which have always dominated Brazil's left. So what I saw a lot more of were really a protest that seemed very influenced by the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States. Now, Brazil, even though it's very similar to the United States in terms of its history of racism, police brutality, slavery, and all the rest of it, there's never really been like a mass Black freedom struggle in Brazil, or race being the leading edge for how people talked about politics and fought oppression. And there's a great deal more of that right now in Brazil, because of any sort of particular book or text or argument or anything like that, but really much more because the level of police killings in Rio in particular has reached levels that are so obscene that I don't think people in the United States can really comprehend them. Like one out of five murders that took place in Rio last year were police officers killing people. One out of five. And overwhelmingly, the victims of these murders are young and Black. And so these protests have developed in that way. And while in the past, when these sorts of police murders, extrajudicial killings took place, it was the union movement that was out front fighting them. That union movement right now is demoralized, split, and all the rest of it because of the problems in the Workers' Party. So it's been, there's just been a lot more of different kinds of organizing happening on the ground. I wonder how much of what we're talking about is going to make it into NBC's Olympic coverage. Probably not too much. But that's the kind of dynamics that I'm seeing there. If I could also say, too, I really, really hate to make everything about Donald Trump, but I read this analysis about Trump that said that one of his points of genius was that he says and does so many outrageous things that it's like lying on a bed of nails. Like if everything is sharp, then nothing has the same impact that it would from somebody else. And I thought that's a lot like what's happening with the Olympics in Brazil. It's like there are so many problems that range from the horrifying to the ridiculous that it's almost like if everything is a problem, then how do you really focus on the one thing that's the most important? So, I find myself writing about things like skydivers who are trying to do Olympic stunts and their parachutes don't come out or get tangled up and they fall to their deaths, or the police killed the Olympic mascot, Juma the Jaguar, because they didn't sedate it properly. And you get those stories that are mixed in with, oh, by the way, there aren't enough resources going into public health in the midst of the explosion of the Zika virus because they have to pay their Olympic bills.
Now, speaking of the Zika virus, there's a lot of issues surrounding this particular Olympics, the Zika virus, the constructions, the stadiums not being
completed. The bed of nails, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So give us a sense of the magnitude of the issues that this set of Olympics are dealing with, and then is this unusual?
That's the second part of your question, I think, is the most important question that's not being asked in certainly the U.S. media. And there is such a temptation. Maybe it's laziness. Maybe it's corruption of corporate media. I'm not even quite sure what the diagnosis is. But there's this temptation to say the problem is Brazil, that Brazil is a dysfunctional society, that Rio is dysfunctional. And it's not to say that there's not truth to that. But when we look at it through that lens, what we also do is we let the International Olympic Committee off the hook. And we don't look that, and we don't recognize that the problems that we're really talking about in Brazil, like forget about the individual crazy stories of jaguars and the rest of it. And you focus on the fact that the main issues are debt, displacement, and the militarization of public space. Well, that's something that affects every country. And like, I was like, for example, just annoyed that members of like the Greek Olympic Committee, they put out this statement condemning the conditions in Rio as if we're not supposed to remember what conditions were like in Athens in 2004, as if that never happened. And as if the former Olympic structures in Athens now aren't being used as squatter settlements for homeless people. And so it's when we focus on Rio specifically, I think we lose sight of the much broader issues that are taking place. Now, that's not to say there aren't things that are specific to Rio, though, as well.
Exactly. Well, you know, I opened by saying how many thousands of security personnel are actually are in Rio. Give us a sense of how serious that problem is, and are they expecting the terrorist attacks on the Olympics?
Well, it's interesting because they certainly are vulnerable. I mean, and that's what's, I think, very scary about it, is that if one was of a mind to do some sort of attack from any political persuasion, this would be, and make an international splash. It's tragic to say this, but this would be the Olympics to do it, because the security situation is kind of a mess. There's no real sense that anybody knows what they're doing. So they're trying to substitute for the fact that they really, you know, Brazil has largely been terror-free despite all the crises in recent decades. So what they're basically they have no real experience or expertise in how to do this. So what they're focusing on instead is just flooding the streets of Rio with officers and police. You mentioned it coming in, 85,000. I mean, it's actually going to end up being more than, according to the latest reports, maybe even more than 85,000. Keep in mind that 85,000, it's twice as many as were in the streets of London in 2012. And it's roughly half the number of U.S. troops in the entire country of Iraq at the height of Bush's war there. And this is just in one city for one Olympics. And so I think they're hoping that a show, of course.
And to protect 10,000 athletes. And I guess,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And to protect 10,000 athletes and spectators.
Exactly. And so they're hoping, I think, the show of force does the trick. The thing about it, though, that's so upsetting is that if for people who know the history of police violence in Rio in particular, you know, who's really going to be the people most likely who get hurt by this incredible ramping up of the security state in Rio? It's most likely going to be the poorest people, the people that they're going to try to make sure stay on lockdown so there aren't stories of, you know, of robberies, of, you know, kidnappings, of all the rest of it. And they will collect. I mean, it's so sad that we know this the way we know that the sun will rise in the east, but there will be a body count in poor communities in Rio as the result of this level of police engagement with the city.
And that's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.